The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From the campus of Kennesaw State University, this is Gold Dome Scramble Live. I'm Ronald Bally, politics reporter for WABE.
And I'm Sam Greenglass, also a WABE politics reporter. This week, we've got a special show planned in front of a live audience ahead of week 7 of the Georgia General Assembly. Later, we're going to talk to Kennesaw State University professor Kerwin Swint for a little history lesson.
And then we have two special guests who are sitting right now up here on the front row, State Representative Rick Jaspers and State Senator Sonia Halpern. But first, Sam, well, let's hit some breaking news and the release of some portions of the special grand jury report investigating former President Trump and his allies and their efforts to overturn the 2020 election results in Georgia.
Well, first, I spent the morning constantly refreshing the docket, waiting for it to load up with these court documents that we've been waiting, I guess, weeks for now. So just to back up for a second, what we're talking about here. For the last 8 months, there has been a special grand jury in Fulton County that has been investigating efforts, as you said, by former President Trump and his allies to tamper with the 2020 election result in Georgia. That process wrapped up in the last couple of weeks. And the special grand jury, before they disbanded, they put together a report. And this report includes some recommendations about what the district attorney should do with all of the stuff they've investigated over these last months. And so this report, it was released today, but we only got basically a very brief glimmer into what has been going on behind closed doors with this investigation. We did not get to see any of the recommendations of the special grand jury, whether they recommended criminal charges should be brought against anyone involved in these efforts. But we did get a couple little takeaways that offer us some clues, one of which is that this whole special grand jury panel unanimously agreed that there was no widespread election fraud in Georgia after the 2020 election. What happens next? We're kind of in waiting mode again. Fulton County District Attorney Bonnie Willis, it will be up to her to decide whether she wants to go before a regular old grand jury and ask them to indict anyone who was potentially involved in all of this. That happens behind closed doors in secret, too. So again, we're just going to be waiting a little while longer.
And to bring it back to the state capitol in you know, why we're talking about here on Gold Dome Scramble is that one of the key focuses of the investigation was the certification of the 2020 presidential election, and specifically in Georgia, the Electoral College slate that was supposed to be for now President Biden. Well, what happened was at the same time, you had a group of Republicans put together their own slate. And in that group includes now Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones and now State Senator Sean Steele. So those are important figures. And of course, you had a number of important state figures who testified, including Governor Brian Kemp, along with the late House Speaker David Ralston. So that's what brings it back to the state capitol. You had things that happened at the state capitol and so many state players involved in this.
So, okay, let's set this news aside for a minute. And I just want to step back a little bit, Raul, as we were hitting the halfway mark roughly in this legislative session. And I'm curious what you make of what we've seen play out under the Gold Dome over these last couple of weeks.
Let me start on a very personal level. there are more than 50 new lawmakers at the state capitol. 50 new people to get to know their names, get their phone numbers, just getting to know new people, you know, kind of on a personal level. Hey, where are you from? Tell me about your district. Tell me about yourself. Well, I used to be this, or I used to be my county administrator. It's kind of that basic thing. As for legislation, I don't have to tell all of y'all about home prices and rent and what people are dealing with. And then the issues around crime, you know, and what to do about crime. And again, it's one thing to talk about those things in the news and what's going on, but it's always interesting to see what the legislation actually looks like. So in the case of crime, there's this big focus on what district attorneys do and what judges do, whether it's mandatory sentencing or discretion of district attorneys. It's really interesting to see, you know, how an issue and things are people talking about and what it looks like as a legislative solution or idea. Sam, this is your second session, and I'd love to hear what you're seeing and what you're feeling, because I love hearing, you know, some of the things that you're bringing up going into your second session.
So I feel like the tenor of the session, and I'm curious to hear from our lawmakers later if they agree with this, feels a little bit different than last year. You know, it was an election year last year, and pretty much right out of the gate, we were hitting the ground running with some of these more divisive bills that really took up a lot of the oxygen in the room. You know, we had bills on how teachers talk about race in classrooms, bills restricting trans kids in sports, in schools. We had bills on loosening gun restrictions. And some of these brought a lot of backlash in the chamber. This session, you know, Governor Kemp has started his second term saying he wants to focus on these kitchen table issues, workforce, housing, tax refunds. And for at least the first couple of weeks, that is largely what we heard being talked about in the session. But I do feel like in these last couple of days, especially, we've started to see glimmers of some other controversial bills that, you know, have brought some intensity in hearings related to schools again, related to crime. And I'll be curious to see how those dynamics play out as we get further along into this session. Speaking of some of these more kitchen table issues that we've talking about, I mentioned housing is one of them. We're finally starting to see some concrete proposals. You know, early on, we heard a lot of talk. We want to do something about housing. Things are not affordable here. Now we have some proposals. There's three buckets, roughly, that these have fit into. Can you just real briefly explain to our audience what it is we're talking about here?
So these were interesting conversations at the Capitol, because I would talk to the players and they had ideas. But now here's the bills that are starting to come out. So when it comes to building new houses and how to make it cheaper and more affordable, there's going to be this fight where the state is going to want to tell local and city governments what they can and can't do, okay? And here's some of the interesting examples. Vinyl siding, you know, should a county or city be able to ban vinyl siding? It makes it cheaper to build a house with vinyl siding, for example, or it makes it cheaper whether you put a garage or not. Now, some counties say, we're going to ban vinyl siding, or you have to have a garage. Well, it makes the house more expensive. That's going to be an interesting fight, because you're going to have state lawmakers saying, look, we need more affordable housing, and the way you do it is with less regulation. You're going to have local and city governments who are going to say, you're not going to take that power away from us, because we want either nicer homes or not. So that's one of the fights that we're going to see, and that legislation is coming from Dale Washburn, who's a real estate broker. The next interesting area has to do with this whole conversation. And raise your hand if you've seen this or have heard about this in your neighborhoods, where corporations or corporate entities are coming in to buy homes either in your neighborhoods or areas. So how do you actually deal with that? We're getting one of the first proposals there, and that's from Democratic State Representative Spencer Fry, who's going to be dropping legislation that's going to take away the ability of corporations to depreciate the homes they buy on their state taxes. That's going to be his approach. I'm looking forward to any financial kind of data that's going to say this is going to make a difference or not, because these are massive corporations who are going to be making certain percentages. I want to see what those numbers look like. But that's the first actual legislative solution I've heard about people coming in to buy homes. Raise your hand if you rent. Got a couple of renters. So there's legislation coming here. And interestingly, on the renting, It's bipartisan, and it's already being backed by Republican Speaker John Burns. One of the things is a limit on your security deposit. It can't be more than 3 times your rent. Do you guys know in the state of Georgia, there is not like basic livability standards for rental properties? There isn't. There is not like even a baseline. So they're going to, that's something that's being worked on. And the other interesting thing is in state law, landlords cannot cut off your heat, but it makes no reference to air conditioning. So that's also going to be in this bill. It's bipartisan, which is interesting because when you talk to Republican lawmakers and Democrats, they realize something has to be done on rentals. So that's some of the things. I know I was supposed to be short and I wasn't, but I find it all interesting because these are some of the solutions being proposed to an issue that we've all heard about. We are on a college campus. By the way, thanks again for everybody here at Kennesaw State University who came out. Some of those battle lines are in the area of higher education and K-12 education, and we're starting to see some of those bills start getting hearings. And so talk about, Sam, some of the bills you've been following, including some from just this week.
So I'm going to focus on one bill for a second that popped up this week that I think has the potential to generate some controversy over the next couple of weeks. That's Senate Bill 88. And what it would do is it would prohibit teachers and some other adults from being able to talk about sexual orientation or gender identity with kids in the classroom if they're under 16, unless they get permission from the parents. This is being compared to a bill that was signed in Florida in recent months that's kind of known as this Don't Say Gay bill. And the sponsors say that this is intended to make sure parents are basically involved in what's going on in their kids' lives. But we also heard from tons of kids who came down to the Gold Dome to talk about how they're worried that this is going to mean that they're not going to be able to have open conversations with adults that they trust when they're at school. So again, this is another one of these issues that affects a lot of people in this room, students, that is very much playing out at the Gold Dome right now. And it's also part of this broader trend that I think we've seen in the last couple of years where debates about schools are not just about funding or curriculum, but they're about how teachers approach what they do in their classroom, how students move through the world in school. And, you know, I think this is something that is going to keep coming up both under the Gold Dome, but also again on the campaign trail when we get to 2024.
Coming up here on Gold Dome Scramble, we'll be talking to two lawmakers who have different roles when it comes to Senate Bill 88. They'll be joining us here in a few minutes. But right now, joining us on stage is Kerwin Swint, professor of political science here at Kennesaw State University. Welcome, Professor Swint.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, so Professor Swint, something that I feel like I didn't fully understand when I first moved to Georgia was that it was actually Democrats, not Republicans, who controlled the levers of power in the state for a really long time. I mean, we're talking decades, going back into the last century. Can you tell me how these Democrats differed from maybe the Democratic Party that we have today in Georgia, and why did they hold on to power so long in this state?
Yeah, a lot of changes. It's interesting because Georgia is actually the last state in the South to elect a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. It's been 50, 60 years that Republicans have been taking over in the South, but you start to have other states like Alabama, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee elect Republican governors back in the 1970s, 1980s. And it wasn't until 2002, of course, that Georgia finally elected its first Republican governor. And the reason the Georgia voters voted Democrat for so long, and Democrats lasted in power for so long, was this coalition between rural white voters and minority voters in metro Atlanta counties. You know, the South has always been a conservative region, a very conservative culturally, very traditional region. And all those conservatives used to be Democrats. There were no Republicans down here. I think the first Republican was seen coming across the Tennessee border in around 1979. But it was a slow motion movement. But that coalition really held on. So you think about Democratic governors in Georgia, people like, and some of these names go back in history, George Busby or Joe Frank Harris, or Zell Miller, right? I mean, they were conservative on most issues, and they were able to hold on to those rural voters who had always voted Democrat. They didn't know any Republicans. And so that's what enabled them to hold on. Even when Georgia voters began voting for Republican candidates for president, like Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, they still were comfortable voting for Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate, U.S. House. And so they split their ticket. Georgia was the home to many ticket splitters. You vote for a Republican candidate for president, Democratic candidate for Congress. That was very, very common. And that didn't really change much until the 80s or 90s. You know, you first started having some Republicans elected to Congress in about the early 1980s, and they started to break in there a little bit. One way they hold on to power, though, and this is true in any legislative majority, is through redistricting, right? Or what is known as gerrymandering. That's where the party that has control in a state legislature, whether it's Democrat or Republican, they both do it, redraw those lines to hopefully reelect as many from their party as possible. And that's one way that you hold on to that majority. So what the Democrats found in the 1990s was that it became harder and harder to draw those lines to elect Democrats. And that's because there had been a lot of people moving here from other states voting Republican. The conservative movement has started to grow in metro Atlanta. You know, so oddly, we started having Republicans in some of these suburban counties. They're now all Democrat, places like Cobb County, Gwinnett County. And so it became harder for them to do that. What also happened was the election of 1998 elected Roy Barnes, governor. When he was running for re-election in 2002, he had some really tough issues, and he got a lot of backlash, especially from teachers, right? He was trying to change the way that teachers get reviews, or they called it tenure. He was trying to, and successfully changed the Georgia flag, you know, got the Confederate battle emblem off of the flag, and there were other issues with transportation, the Northern Arc, remember that? That was a controversial issue, and some people are smiling. You may remember that. So I always thought those are the three issues that defeated Roy Barnes. It wasn't Sonny Perdue. Sonny Perdue benefited from that. He won the election in 2002, but then ushered in a period of Republican dominance. When Sonny Perdue was elected in 2002, they were able to get a majority in the state Senate that year. And if I remember right, there were one or two Democratic state senators who changed parties to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then between 2002 and 2004, they actually won a majority in the Georgia House as well. So there was some party switching going on, but that's been going on for decades. I mean, Sonny Perdue, former Democrat. Governor Deal, former Democrat, right? So all these Democrats, these Southern conservative Democrats, most of them changed to Republicans by the 80s, 90s, 2000s. It just took longer in Georgia for that to enable the Republican Party to take control.
So how is the shift we're seeing now different from that shift? Obviously, you're going from one direction to the other, but how is this different, you know, whether it's speed or what's actually happening?
Well, a lot of it is just growth. The metro Atlanta area has just exploded in growth, and a lot of that is driven by people moving into the state. A lot of people moving here from places like California, Texas, New York, Michigan, all over. I mean, you could name every state. And a lot of those folks are voting Democrat. And so really the opposite is happening. Now you have the Republican strength is now out in the rural areas where the Democratic strength used to be. So it's sort of flipped. It's flipped on its head.
So you're talking about this demographic shift that is happening. A lot of times you hear Democrats talk about demographics being destiny in the state, that these trends are going to keep happening. The state is going to keep getting bluer and bluer. But I wonder, do you think it's going to be this clear line to Democratic power again in the state? Or are there going to be twists and turns and bumps along that road?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of twists and turns. I mean, demography is destiny sometimes. You know, and there's no doubt that the Democratic Party has benefited from a lot of this migration into Georgia, people from other states, but also younger people voting in higher numbers, voting more Democrat the last 5 or 6 years. So the demographics are there, but there's a couple of caveats to that. You know, one thing I've always said is, yeah, Georgia is trending blue, But let's see what Latino voters do over the next 5 to 10 years. There's a lot of evidence, for example, that Latino voters are starting to vote Republican in some elections, in some races, especially a place like Florida. But Brian Kemp did well with Hispanic Georgians also. So that's sort of a, could be a twist in that turn to a bluer Georgia. So we are turning blue, no doubt. No doubt about it. If you look at the elections over the last number of years, it's happening. The thing is, though, Georgia now is still a red state. You know, I know there's been a lot of talk about Georgia flipping. And
I did a whole story, is Georgia purple or not?
You know what it is? Georgia is red with streaks of purple. That's how I look at it. And I say that because Brian Kemp and every other Georgia executive branch candidate just won re-election fairly easily. You had every, you know, attorney general, secretary of state on down the line. They all won relatively easily. The legislature is still in Republican hands. Now, part of that is through redistricting, but part of it is also through just simply having, you know, candidates that are able to appeal to their voters in those rural areas. Streaks of purple, though, obviously the metro areas. Metro Atlanta, very Democratic. We were looking at the returns election night when Raphael Warnock beat Herschel Walker. And Herschel Walker did well in those rural counties. People came out to vote for Herschel. But, man, Metro Atlanta counties exploded on that December 6th runoff for Raphael Warnock. So that's where the votes are, is the metro areas of the state. That's where the Democrats are competitive. But it's going to take some time. It's going to take some time. We'll see where we end up in 5 or 10 years. I think it's going to be competitive from now on. It's not going to be a blue state or a red state, I don't think, in the next 10 years.
Professor Kerwin Swind of Kennesaw State University, thanks for welcoming us to your house, and thanks for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure.
Let's take a quick break. You're listening to WABE's Gold Dome Scramble, live from the campus of Kennesaw State University.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Gold Dome Scramble. Now let's bring on two newsmakers, two lawmakers. We're really, really happy to have joining us tonight State Representative Rick Jaspers, a Republican from Jasper in North Georgia. Welcome, Representative.
We're glad to be here tonight. Yeah, on my way home from the Capitol, it's a nice stop.
And we also have State Senator Sonia Halpern, a Democrat from Atlanta.
Hello. I blew past my house to get here, but I'm really glad to be here at Kennesaw State with you tonight.
So I want to have you both talk a little bit about your districts and what it means to represent a group of communities that have some shared interests, but also might have some conflicting ones. Senator Halpern, your district includes Buckhead, a wealthy neighborhood. It also includes Bankhead, Southwest Atlanta, some suburbs. How do you represent all of those different people and what they care about as one representative?
I love this question because I love my district. So my district, as you said, it's a north-south district. So at the northernmost point, I have the neighborhood of Buckhead in Atlanta, and it cuts a trail through the heart of Atlanta and then on down to the cities of College Park, City of South Fulton, East Point, and parts of Union City. It is, in fact, one of the most socioeconomically diverse districts in the state, as well as the country. And so what I love about my district, it is very different, like the north side from the south side. But ultimately, the issues that people care about really are the same. Does not matter where you are in my district. People are concerned about education. They're concerned about, you know, employment opportunities. They all want to have, you know, great public safety where they live and transportation. So even though the kind of profile of the constituents are different, their concerns are really the same. And what I really have to balance is the different approaches to dealing with the concerns. So that's really where the work is for me, you know, there's nuance to that. But the issues themselves are the same, so it makes it very easy for me to go down to the Capitol and know what it is that I'm really fighting for.
So as a senator, you're one of 56, yes. Which means it's 56 slices of Georgia. State Representative Jaspers, you are a representative of a much smaller House district. There's 180 House members. Talk about the slice of Georgia that you represent.
Yeah, it's a very dramatically different than the senators is. I live in Jasper. My district is very rural. You know, it goes from Hinton, Jasper, Talking Rock, Marble Hill, Ball Ground to Cumming. It's a giant across the state area. Very diverse. I mean, similar to the senators, yeah, I can go from a very poor, no restroom home to multi-million dollar houses within blocks of each other. And it's just like Senator said, the issues are all the same. People are people and they have needs of their own, but it's very, very different. Very Republican, 85% Republican district. I've been there for 13 years. Know the area well, it's a great area because it's beautiful. It's where people from Cobb County, from down here, move to. And, you know, they're covering us up. You know, there's a lot of, it's a land buying spree going on in North Georgia for folks moving up there just to get away.
So we've heard a little bit about both of your districts. I want to turn to policy now for a second. We talked a little bit about some of these education bills that have been cropping up this session and past sessions. Senator Halpern, I want to start with you. You sit on the Senate Education Committee. I'm curious, do you see a theme or a through line between some of these bills that have been more controversial that have come up in the last couple of years in your committee?
I do. I think the most obvious answer to that response, right, is that it is targeting children, kids who are transgender, for example, or around sexual identity and gender identity. I think that's like the obvious one. For me, I think the other part that we have to be talking about is that the common thread is, and I said this actually in the hearing that we had on SB 88 earlier this week, you know, there is a relationship and should be a partnership between school and home, but a lot of these bills really in the interest of making sure that parents' rights are accentuated, it is changing the ability of teachers, right, to play an important role in that school-home partnership. And I think that's the challenge. A lot of the bills that we've been seeing add a lot of administrative burden to our faculty and administrators. A lot of these bills, in fact, provide just more of a closed box for them, much more limiting way for teachers to be able to interact with their students and therefore teach their students. And I think that's, you know, in addition to the obvious targeting of young people, I think that's really the thing too that we have to understand is happening, is that we're making our teachers' jobs harder when it is already hard enough, and when we're seeing really a crisis in the teacher shortage, with teachers really, you know, reporting back out in surveys that they wouldn't recommend the job to other people, young people who are just starting careers and could be the right kinds of folks that we want in these classrooms.
Representative Jaspers, before I bring the question to you, I want to talk a little bit about your background. Before you were the chairman of the Transportation Committee in the Georgia House, you were the chairman of the Education Committee.
Yes.
And you still sit on education. So let me ask a bigger question about, you know, all this legislation that you've seen come through on education, how parents communicate with the school system, how teachers communicate with parents, how teachers, you know, communicate with students. What's the bigger reason? What's the bigger forces that are behind that?
Oh, I think that's pretty easy. But I'll tell you about being the education chairman. It's what, probably 30 different chairmanships in the House. Education is the most difficult one. I was higher ed chairman for a few years, and then I was asked to do education, I guess because of my ability to communicate and talk with people in very stressful situations. Every one of these bills, as Senator said, are passion. because we have great passion in Georgia for children of all kinds and all over the state. You know, you look at in our state budget, over 55% of the money that we all in this room spend is spent in education. And so that focus is just paramount down there. And, you know, and what I try to do as the chairman of it is listen. I mean, you try to listen to both sides or in many education issues, six sides, and decide whether you think that bill needs to move forward or it doesn't. And I think on my side, many times, I'm listening to parents very clearly, you know, because they have the most invested. It's their children. It's their ideas and their protection of their love, the reason they're alive. And it's always been really at the base of what I looked at as a chairman of a committee, especially one that's there. And, you know, and we see a lot of bills. It's even increased. I think the last year that I was a chairman of education, we had like 38 bills of all different sizes.
Walk me through what's going to be your process with Senate Bill 88, if it, assuming it gets
that's,
out of your committee.
That's the transgender bill?
Yes.
Yeah.
Assuming it gets out of your committee, and it sounds like there's a lot of work that still has to be done on that bill.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk about that first, and then I want to hear your process there.
Okay. So we got the bill, and the bill had already had a substitute. So just a little bit about process here. We have an idea for a bill. We must, all of us, every legislator must go to legislative council, and they're a team of lawyers and attorneys, and they draft our bills for us. We then collect signatures from our colleagues that are in agreement with our bill, and we introduce the bill, and then it gets a number. So this is Bill SB 88. At that point, the bill can go, well, it gets assigned to a committee, and the committee chairman really does have the authority to decide what bills are going to be brought forward to the committee or are not going to be heard at all. SB 88 was heard earlier this week in the Education and Youth Committee. And at the very start of the meeting, which was interesting, Chairman Dixon, who chairs Education and Youth, had said this is going to be a hearing only. Two things can happen in a committee meeting. You can hear testimony and then take a vote as a committee on whether you want to pass the bill, do pass, or not do not pass. Or you can just have a hearing, and you have the opportunity for people, really anybody, can come and sign up, whether you're an individual or an organization, to speak for or against the bill. So we started the meeting understanding it was going to be a hearing only, and we had a substitute already, so this is changes have already been made to the bill, and they started the meeting by saying the author of the bill said, we're already working with other organizations. So from the get on this one, they recognize that that it's not right, it's not in its final shape, and in fact, you know, they are talking to Georgia Equality, they are talking to teachers' organizations, and so they're talking to some of the folks that have stated disapproval of the bill, and we'll see what happens when it comes back to us in terms of the changes and the massaging that they're going to make to it to possibly accommodate for some of the feedback that they're receiving.
So to be fair, you know, because Senate Bill 88 could change a lot, but give me your general thoughts, State Representative Jaspers, about conversations, what conversations teachers and other educators should or should not have with children in a school setting.
Well, I think of this particular bill, it's going to be one that when it comes from you guys to us over Crossover Day in the hearings that we'll have in the House, it's one of those bills that just sucks the air out of the building just because there's so many people there to testify for it and against it. And I think you'll see a very measured approach, you know, just by the chairman of that committee, as I would. You'll listen. You'll take what the Senate's done. You know, they may have messed it up. And, you know, and you know, we say that to each other.
Well, and sometimes we're just like, they'll fix it in the House, which is terrible. You know, we're like, let's just get it out of here and they'll fix it.
Yeah, and we'll look at it. You know, but I think you'll see from the majority party, and I can't speak for all 110 or you know, all 100 of us, is that we're going to look at protecting children. I can't say that clear enough. And that's going to be, I know that would be my goal, and looking at children and you know, protecting them until they're of an age that they can make a reasonable decision. But that'll be the, that will be a great, it's, you know, it's fun. And I think, you know, you, I say fun, not meaning in a just, but the debate in the legislature is outstanding. I had a committee meeting last Thursday on a very controversial subject that lasted 6.5 hours.
We're going to talk about that hearing in a second.
And, you know, but that's what we do. And I want to make sure that people understand that that's what will happen on this bill. It'll be well vetted. You know, some people are going to like the outcome. Some people aren't. You know, that's why we pick sides in different parties. But and I don't think it'll be a party vote. I think you'll see individuals in the Republican Party vote for it, and some will vote against it. Some, on, and especially on the Democrat side, too, because they feel similarly on protecting children.
Representative Jaspers, I want to stick with you for a second, but before I ask you another question, I just think something that you raised a moment ago is really important, which is deciding which of the hundreds and hundreds of bills we focus on every day. I mean, I think that is one of the hardest parts of our job as journalists covering the legislature is, okay, our audience, you all out there, do not have time to follow 1,000 bills. I don't have time to follow 1,000 bills. But how do we decide what are the important ones our audience needs to know about? What is the controversial one that's maybe not going to go anywhere, but do we need to tell our audience about it? Which ones do we need to explain in depth? Which ones do we need to note happened? Which ones do we just have to let it go? And that's a constant balancing act. And I imagine that's one that you all are dealing with too, because you only have so much attention.
Yeah, you have so much wavelength that you can deal with, even for us. And, you know, it's going to sound weird, but I listen to WABE when I'm out at Apple Valley Farm doing whatever, you know, because I need to catch up. You know, I'm a very busy person in the Capitol, and I can't keep up with what this, my fine senators are doing, but I rely on you and others to kind of fill me in. And I think that's what we need to do as citizens, is have a very broad look at all the information that's out there. I've got probably 3 or 4 newspapers, 6 or 8 different little sources I get every day just so I can keep up. And y'all are pretty good about honing on the things that really are important and that they're coming through. You don't waste people's time very often. But I just want to caution you on one thing as I talk about this. Be careful on advocacy groups. You know, I don't know about you, Senator, but me, today, since lunch, I've gotten 700 emails. Okay, now, what I'll do is I've got this great intern. Tomorrow morning, he'll go through them. He'll look and see if they're from my area or not, and he'll kind of go through them and answer them with another just blank email, just like they sent me. But what he's looking for is an email from you. It could be on the same subject, and McKay will be very careful to say, oh, Chairman Jaspers, here's one from your area, or some from a person with a real question, not just punch this button and send your state legislator a question. Y'all, that ain't effective. It just clogs us up. But if you have an opinion and you take the time to write, Chairman Jaspers, Rick, hope you say Rick, tell me what's up with this, and this is what I think. I guarantee you'll get an answer, especially if you're from up my neck of the way, anywhere near me.
Which emails do you read, Senator? Which contacts are you looking at, whether it's social or otherwise? What are you reading?
So I tend to look at them all, even if it's just a glance. And I'll notice, so I will, just like the representative, I will look for the ones where I'm sure that they're in my district to try to respond to. But I am noting, even when I get one and it literally all reads the same and it's clear that somebody pushed the button, I am trying to note how many I'm getting around a topic so that I can really understand what's the feedback that I'm receiving, even if it's outside of my district, but from around the state on pro or con on this particular issue. Because then it also helps me sometimes to focus in more on that and really have to be much more sharp in my way of thinking around that bill. And that's the beautiful thing about debate, right? And being able to hear from both sides is ultimately you take everything that you hear, and then you're able to form, well, a more informed decision around the action that you're going to take around a bill.
Representative Jaspers, I want to ask you about a policy issue that came up this week. A group of Democrats held a press conference earlier this week pushing for safe storage laws around guns that might be accessible by children. I know you've worked a lot on a lot of gun-related issues. I'm curious, like, is there any possible bill related to any regulations on guns that there is room for some kind of bipartisan compromise on? I know, you know, Representative Au, who's carrying that bill, said she couldn't find a Republican sponsor on
it. Sure. Yeah, I think that's probably the most passionate issue in the building by far, and in our total environment, because it's just driven that way. But I think for me personally, you know, I guess because I do lead in a lot of the Second Amendment issues in the Capitol, is I look at the individual and the protection that it offers them. And, you know, on safe storage, it's just one of those things, it just sounds good at first breath and your first thought. But then again, I look across the state. I live in downtown Atlanta right now. I go by some pretty shady places. And if I'm living there and I'm a grandmother in my house and I need a weapon to defend myself, do I want to have to go somewhere else to get it? I think we need to do education at this moment about storage. And, you know, when I grew up, my dad was a Marine. I was trained and my sister on weapons. And we've gotten away from that. We've gotten to a little bit polarized where some people are afraid or they don't want them. And then there's some people who do to an extreme sometimes. And it's on both ends. But we've got to get back to talking about common sense ways that we can talk about storage, responsibility. Constantly when I talk about, you know, having a weapon is to be trained. You know, one of my biggest sponsors and helpers in my district is a shooting range, because they know I believe in what they're doing and they do it all the time. And I think that usually we'd come up with the bills in this world that are too far outside that we can't come to agreement on.
One thing that I think we should maybe talk about is Democrats in the minority, one, don't have really power to even get a committee hearing on bills that don't have Republican supporters. And I guess this kind of reflects some of the challenges of being in the minority in this
party.
Moment. There's only so much you guys can do right now.
It's true. And so if we have bills, and I've signed on to that bill, so I'm a sponsor of the one you just referenced. And so if we can't get hearings, then we can do press conferences, and we can still get it out to the world that these are the things that we're thinking about, these are the things that we care about, here are the reasons why. And then we actually hope that those emails get sent in, and then it's just a reminder that, you know, this is not just us, that we as the minority party really are representative of a larger group of people, and that, you know, at least to be able to get a hearing means that we're beginning a conversation around finding a solution that both parties can agree to. And ultimately, though compromise has become such a dirty word in politics, I mean, ultimately, really what we need to be able to do, right? And the hope is that we are able to be in communication with each other, and where there is overlap, at least move on that. And then you can build on that moving forward.
I want to talk about that 5.5, nearly 6-hour hearing, not only because you chaired that hearing, but to me, it is representative of everything I was talking about before the show about the power of state government and everything that has to happen with it. In the state of Georgia right now, the vast majority of trucks are limited to 80,000 pounds max. There is now a proposal to allow that go up to 90,000 pounds, an extra 5 tons. That bill was heard in his committee, scheduled for a 2-hour hearing, nearly hit 6 hours. And I want to ask you about why you let it go that long. But also, the people who testified and all the forces that were there, you had safety advocates there saying, you add another 5 tons, it's that much more the truck has to stop. You had a father there from Virginia whose child was killed by a tractor trailer. You had locals in city governments and the Georgia Department of Transportation commissioner saying, look, this is not linear. It's exponential what you're doing to the roads and how much it's going to shorten the life of roads. You had local governments saying this is going to cost us more for our roads and maybe even bring more traffic. On the other side, you had business interests. You had the agriculture industry, poultry industry, forestry industry saying, look, We have a truck driver shortage. We need bigger loads. Georgia's trying to be, you know, trying to remain one of the top states to do business.
This issue sounds really wonky, but the reason that we're bringing it up is because I think it's kind of a perfect example of why what happens under the Gold Dome is really important. I mean, it's this issue that affects all of us in ways that maybe we might not imagine. We all drive on roads. We all get food and wood and to build the furniture in our house. And yet you've got people on all different sides of this issue coming in front of your committee to talk about their feelings about it, about a piece of legislation. So I guess talk to us about that.
Well, sure. And it, you know, and that's the beauty about being a chairman of a committee. And yeah, I did a little bait and switch. I did have I'm down for like a 3-hour or 2-hour meeting, and it did end up being 6. But that's the wisdom of being down there for 13 years and knowing that I needed to make sure that every one of those people that had came from different parts of Georgia had an opportunity to testify in front of 30 committee members who sat there for 6 hours. Now, we did take 2 breaks. And I say that slowly because I want you to think about the dedication of the Transportation Committee members to sit there for 6 hours. They asked 89 questions of the people who were there. And, you know, and it was tough. I mean, there's some gut-wrenching parts of it, but and some very tense parts of it. But, you know, both sides got their, you know, you kind of did the against thing without talking about the pro too much, because right now over here on I-75 there are trucks going up and down that road with 93,000 pounds, and it's legal because we have an executive order by the governor that allowed that through COVID that continues to this day. If they're on the interstate, they can have up to 100,000 pounds coming out of the port because we can't do anything about it. It's a federal, you say, interstate trail. And so those two little things right there drive this issue. That the guys who are, we had this great farmer, pulpwood, timber guy now who started out with a stick truck, which you don't know what it is, but loading by hand, to now buying brand new equipment because of this last 3 years, he's been able to invest in equipment because of his ability to do a better job. And so we have to weigh all this stuff out. And, you know, some of it's very passionate. You know, reason doesn't always engage in the legislature. You know, I just have to say that. You look at sometimes that I want to help that guy. I want to help that lady. I want to protect this person. And, you know, we do that. Comes out, insurance. You would think under this higher weight limit, insurance limits would go through the school, out the sky. They've done nothing. You know, when you look at the accidents that are caused by you, the people in this room who pull out in front of trucks, who cut trucks off. It's not them. They do a great job. You think about an individual that owns a company. There's a great discussion about that. And so it was wonderful. I had great praise about the meeting because we gave every member the opportunity to talk. And I think that's what you see generally in most of the General Assembly, is you get your chance. You're an elected person. And, you know, and I'm very kind of funny about it. I'm elected. By gosh, I want to have my say. And I do, and I take advantage of that, and I encourage all my members to.
An interesting representation on that committee hearing is that bill did end up passing your committee.
It did.
But you had some Republicans vote against it.
Absolutely.
You had, you know, representatives who from rural areas or representatives who heard from the city governments. And to kind of follow along with that, what is your position as an Atlanta representative on that issue?
We have a similar bill in the Senate that I actually signed on to. So I am for increasing the weight. And I am for increasing the weight because I am thinking about the businesses and the business owners and their need to move product. And Georgia made product, you know? Things that we are producing here, whether it's poultry, whether it's our agriculture. But we've got to be able to move our own goods throughout the state and beyond. And so I am actually for it. And I think that's one of the things, you're raising a great point. There is a lot of tension often between like urban and rural. But at the end of the day, if we think of ourselves as a state senator, which I am, and yes, I represent District 39, but I have to think about what I think is for the greater good of the state and for folks who don't know my name, may never meet me, but whose interest I also need to consider. So I'm actually for it.
And I want to throw out one thing if I can, Ronald, but what it's made, you know, like there's unintended consequences in everything that we do down there. But what it has made crystal clear to the 35 members that are in that committee is we don't have enough money to maintain the roads and bridges in our state, throughout our state, even in downtown where you are, to the ability that you want us to. Now, we do raise a lot of money through the gasoline excise tax, but Georgia's a fast-growing state, requires a lot of new roads and expansion and moving and building and replacing bridges and paving constantly. You know, we just don't have enough money. And that's coming out. I think it's one of the good things of this whole discussion, even the Senate Transportation yesterday, that was the number one thing they talked about.
Senator Halperin, you made a really interesting point there, which is that some divides in the Gold Dome do not necessarily break down on Republican-Democrat lines all the time. Like, we think that they might. There's urban-rural. There's business, grassroots, there's all kinds of divides. So I think that's something that we don't often think about, but is important to understand. As we're getting ready to wrap up here, I want to ask you all one last question, which is, you all don't make a ton of money doing this job. And at a time when it's easy to be disheartened or pessimistic about politics, about government, I'm curious what makes you want to keep getting up every morning and going to the State House to do this work?
Well, we've recently gotten a raise because we got COLA. When we did the cost of living adjustment for all state employees, we actually got $5,000 additional dollars like every other state employee. So we're at $22,000 a year now. And it really is, we are considered a part-time legislature. The truth of the matter is, it's not a part-time job. I think every single one of us who are down there, you know, really are vested in what we're doing. And when we are out of session and go back into our districts or in our districts even during session, I mean, we're very serious about making sure that we're out in the community and meeting with the different kinds of constituents while we're a part-time legislature. There have been movements for us to make more, even from amongst legislators. I mean, it would increase the pool of people if we got paid more who would be able to afford to actually still live and represent Georgians. I personally, because, you know, I've just got elected for the first time in 2020, so I am just at the start of my second term and understood what I was walking into in terms of salary. I'd actually be more interested in seeing our office budgets increase so that we could have more staff and more, you know, ability to get into our districts or have even true district offices and that kind of a thing.
It's just like Sandra said, last year I was the chairman of two statewide study committees on electric vehicles and freight logistics funding. I've also been the chairman of the Rural Development Council, went all over the state every summer I've done it for like 7 years, been the chairman of that thing. And so it's a full-time job. Just like she said, we are very out in the state. You've got to be. You can't trust lobbyists to tell you what's going on. You've got to see it for yourself and know what you're doing is the right thing. And you just got to have a passion for it, you know, and have the financial ability to do it also.
Representative Rick Jaspers, Senator Sonja Halperin, thanks so much for joining us on Gold Dome Scramble.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Gold Dome Scramble, live from the campus of Kennesaw State University. You can find more Georgia politics coverage on the radio at 90.1 and online at WABE.org. You can find our sister podcast, Political Breakfast, wherever you get your podcasts. WABE is also on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok.
Our producer is Kevin Rinker. Our managing editor is Alex Helmick. A special thank you to WABE's Aisha Greenlee, Sherry Day Scott, and Sawyer Vanderwerf, along with the folks here at Kennesaw State University, for putting together tonight's live show. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you. At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.